Dad Bod Rap Pod.
Dad Bod Rap Pod. Hello, everybody. This is Nate LeBlanc, the show's producer and co-host, sitting in for my fellows, David Ma and Damone Carter. We're here on a Monday for a special mini episode of Dad Bod Rap Pod on the amazing, spectacular, must-see documentary, Summer of Soul. We've got a great interview with the movie's producer, Joseph Patel, today. Joseph is a longtime music journalist and a friend of friends and someone we've been wanting to talk to for a while. He was also involved with Soulside's crew, which is, you know, a huge touchstone for us, which we get into a little bit towards the end of the show. But today we're here to talk about Summer of Soul. Catch it in theaters, catch it on Hulu, catch it however you can. It's truly must-see. And, you know, we don't cover a ton of soul music here on the show, but we're all huge fans of the music and grew up listening to stuff like this and still very interested in things like this. So we wanted to bring you this special segment. Also like to take a moment to invite Amir Questlove Thompson. If you happen to hear this, we'd love to talk to you about your storied career and, of course, the film on Dad Bod Rap Pod. If you happen to catch this, let's get in touch. That'd be amazing. All right, so let's talk about Summer of Soul for a minute. It's a music documentary, a concert film, a piece of history. And to kind of set the stage for you guys, I asked David and Damone to contribute each a tweet-length review of the film. So here is a tweet-length review of Summer of Soul from music journalist David Ma, who's written extensively on soul music in Wax Poetics, The Guardian, many other places, and just a huge music head in general. Packed with mostly unseen footage, Summer of Soul is a joyous and spellbinding celebration of black culture, a joyous concert film and sobering snapshot of lost American history. At best, it's a time capsule that shows how racism can marginalize even the biggest of cultural moments. At worst, it's possibly the greatest concert film ever made. So high praise from our man David Ma there. Next up is the tweet-length review from Damone Carter, a very soulful person who grew up hearing this music in his home. See Summer of Soul. Rub it on your gums. Put it in your veins. This is an essential piece of black history, which is to say, American history. Quite possibly the greatest concert film ever made. So you're seeing a kind of consensus emerge here. We are huge on this movie, and we're not the only ones, as you'll hear in the interview with Joseph Patel. It's just being rapturously received by audiences everywhere and the kind of film establishment. I would not be surprised if Quest and Joseph are on stage at the Oscars next year accepting the award for Best Documentary. So let's get into it. This is our interview with Joseph Patel, producer of the must-see, extravagant, extraordinary, special film, Summer of Soul.
Dad Bod Rap Pod, every week we have conversations with people who are moving and shaping hip-hop culture. This week is no different. Joining us in Zoom, we have acclaimed film producer Joseph Patel, whose new documentary is the greatest music documentary of all time. Sorry, not to be embarrassing. Joseph, welcome to the program, man. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, we're big fans of the doc, obviously. We'll definitely dig into that. But I wanted to ask a question kind of just selfishly because I've never spoken to a actual movie producer before. Two-part question. What does a producer do on a movie? And how did you get into this line of work?
Well, it's funny because this is my first feature. So I don't know. it's a new experience for me. I mean, I started producing video in 2004. Mm-hmm. I was working at MTV. I came in as a writer. 6 months after that, I did a piece on the Roots. The Roots factor very crucially through a couple different career points for me. I did a piece on the Roots. They were recording a new album. I went down with a producer at MTV to do the story. I pitched the story. I did the interviews. I told him what to shoot. I came back. I wrote the script. We edited it. It aired with his name as producer, my name nowhere to be found. And I said, well, why are you the producer if I did all this stuff? He's like, well, what you actually did is producing. Mm. And I was like, oh, I want to do that because it was just a different form of storytelling for me. And so I did short form video news pieces there. Then I ended up 6 months later doing a TV series I created called My Block. Mm-hmm. And then I went at various jobs ever since. I've done like video pieces and profiles and music videos and commercials. And this is my first feature film. But what I tell people the producer does is you are responsible for the story from conception to completion. Mm. So it's everything from finding the right director to getting the right writer to locations to so-and-so needs red Twizzlers at 2 a.m. in order for them to be functional on camera the next day. That's your job. So even if you're not physically the one doing it, you are responsible for it. So that's sort of my shorthand answer. The producer is responsible from conception to completion. On movies, I think it's different. On documentaries, I think it's different from how it is on scripted films. But generally, it's the people that get the thing made and get it done. My role on this film, though, Summer of Soul, is a little different in that I was a producer in sort of the nuts and bolts way of like, you know, how are we going to shoot this? How do we find the people that went to the festival? Releases, research, all that stuff. But also somewhat of a creative collaborator with Amir because, you know, he had never directed a film before. He is a natural storyteller, but it was a real collaborative effort. So I like to think of my role more as a creative producer.
Thank you for that, man. I really appreciate that. That's a very
long-winded answer. I'm sorry.
No, that's what we're here for. And, you know, I'm sure we're going to be jumping around a little bit with your career and different career arcs and stuff. But just, you know, just watching the documentary, what hit me the most was just obviously all the epic footage, right? From Nina to like Stevie starting off with the drums. Now, so I just wanted to ask you, like, of all this crazy footage, like, which of it struck you the most where you're just like in awe when you first saw it?
I mean, all of it, its mere existence was left me awestruck, right? Like when the person who approached me about this was like, did you know about this music festival in Harlem in 1969? Took place across 6 weekends, 300,000 people went, same summer as Woodstock. Stevie Wonder, Mahalia Jackson, Sly and the Family Stone, Nina Simone, like the list goes on. And I'm just like, this never happened. We would have heard about it, right? Mm-hmm. No, it happened. And not only did it happen, but someone shot the whole thing. Oh, probably one person with a camera. Right? Home video camera, 16mm. So no, 4-camera shoot, professional TV producer. It's all there. And I'm like, I don't know, really skeptical. Take a look at the footage and you're like, okay, this is incredible. And then the next artist comes on, you're like, wow, this is incredible. And then it keeps going. And you're just like, how does this exist and no one really knows about it? Not only the footage, but the event itself. How do we, as a society, even like a music nerd like me, and then an even greater music nerd like Amir, not know that this happened? That's the general awestruckness of it all. I mean, I have favorite parts. A lot of them are in the film. You know, we did, obviously it's 40 hours of footage. The film is 2 hours long. It's not even a straight concert film. So there's a lot that didn't go in, but some of my favorite things that are in the film are like the Stevie drum solo is the first thing Amir wanted to do from the beginning. The first idea he had where it was like, yeah, this is his film. A lot of people don't know Stevie could drum like that. Nobody knew he was nice like that on the drums, right? Mahalia and Mavis is the emotional center of the film. The fact that Mahalia Jackson passes the torch literally to the young Mavis Staples in a Harlem audience, in front of a Harlem audience, and we've been deprived of that footage in that moment for 52 years is crazy. I really love the gospel stuff. Gospel music is not music that I would say that I am knowledgeable or fluent in or a fan of generally. But in 69, gospel is emerging out of the churches into mixing with more secular sounds. And you get some really crazy stuff. You know, Oh Happy Day is basically Pharrell's Happy for 1969. Right. you know, Clara Walker and the Gospel Redeemers are doing psych rock, trance-inducing gospel covers or gospel versions of like popular soul songs. Professor Herman Stevens and the Voices of Faith are they're the gospel group in the white suits and the blue shirts. And like, there's one singer that looks like she looks like Biz Markie is what we always called her when we referred to her in the footage. And then at the end, there's this guy who's going dumb, like Mac Dre would, like in the, and it's just so, it's like it, this, yeah, the whole thing is endless.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I read a little bit about some of the difficulties that you had making this during COVID and, you know, the interviewing process with Mavis Staples and things like that. Can you just shed a little bit more light on perhaps some of the impediments that you had to overcome making this during COVID?
Yeah, like, so I think we started on the film in 2018, end of 2018, generally started like in pre-production and research, and then started pre-production officially in 2019. And, you know, we had shot a bunch of stuff through February of 2020. And then we had a last batch of interviews to do in March of 2020. And they were key interviews. They were Charlene Hunter Galt and Mavis Staples and Stevie Wonder hadn't been done yet. And it was a last batch of interviews, and then everything gets shut down. And so Charlene Hunter Galt was actually on a Monday after the Friday where everything shut down. Mm-hmm. And I was still like arguing with the production company bosses to like, let me drive down to Florida and do this interview with her. And they were like, look, you can do that, but she's, you know, she's elderly. Or I should say, maybe that sounds, I don't know, maybe
she's an elder.
That's a little pejorative of a word, but she's an elder. She's at risk. Don't put her at risk. And I was like, yeah, okay. So we did a phone interview with her, and then we decided to spend some time editing with what we had and just leave blank pockets for things that we knew were coming in future interviews. We figured a few weeks, couple months, we'll have some clarity on the pandemic and we'll know what to do. We didn't quite have the clarity of it being resolved, so we had to get creative. And it's interesting, like from a production standpoint, people came up with really creative solutions. Somehow people figured out how to shoot remotely through Zoom, right? So you have an expensive camera and an expensive lens on one end, and then you don't even have to go to set. You're looking at the frame through Zoom. And so we ended up doing that. We did some interviews outdoors because it was summertime. Mavis was the only exception where her and her manager basically were like, listen, there's no incentive for her to even take a risk to be in the presence of anybody. Mm-hmm. So, I would say the same thing if it were my people, right? My family or someone I managed or even myself, like I would not take that risk. But this moment between her and Mahalia Jackson was so important to her in her life and her career that she was willing to let us drop a sanitized microphone delivered by our sound engineer in a hazmat suit to her apartment complex and walk her through how to set it up. She knows how to set up a microphone, but had then log onto Zoom and do the interview so we could record at least the audio. But yeah, it forced us to get really innovative with how we shot the remaining interviews, but also how we edited, right? Our editor was editing remotely from upstate New York. And usually you're in the room with each other and you're able to give notes and have feedback and have, hey, Amir, come in here and watch this cut. We weren't able to do that. So we used a software program called Evercast that simulates being in the room together where I could see what my editor had on screen. And we were also on Zoom at the same time. So I could say, oh, you'd show me, hey, what do you think of this? And I'd could give him notes in real time. So that kind of saved us. But it's funny, we finished the movie during the pandemic. So we weren't able to actually watch this all in a room together. Some of us watched it, but as a team that made this film, we weren't able to watch it in a room together. And we certainly didn't see it on a big screen until very late in the process, I think like April or May.
That's incredible. Thank you for kind of giving us that glimpse behind the scenes.
These are all too long answers. Let me know.
It's all good, man. Just be yourself, please. We like to be a home for nuanced conversation. So there's so many places I want to go here, but I guess the main thing, if this is the only chance we ever have to get to talk about this, is there anything you can share about, I understand that the footage was in a vault for 50 years. Why was it in a vault for 50 years? Like, did the person who shot it just not have the right connections? Was there just like every network and every production company ever passed? Did he only solicit it right when he first had it fresh? Like, do you understand what I'm asking? Can you give us a little bit on that?
So I think it's look, in the film itself says that the footage hasn't been seen in 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. Which is technically, I would say, largely true. It's nothing in the film is inaccurate. There are a couple of things have leaked on YouTube through the years, right? A little bit of the Nina Simone performance was licensed for the Nina Simone documentary, but out of 40 hours, largely you can say it hasn't been seen in 50 years. You know, Hal Tolchin shot this in 1969 on spec. The city had come together with Tony Lawrence, had come together with Maxwell House. General Foods was like, we need to shoot, Hal wants to shoot this, we're gonna shoot this. Hal is an experienced TV producer. He shoots it on four cameras, runs it off into two decks. Very innovative way he shot it on 2-inch videotape. It's in these gigantic 2-inch reels. Each one is like 20 pounds each.
That's right.
Beautiful Tiffany blue cases. Like, he wants to sell these as 5 national TV specials to create a cultural moment. These artists of this caliber in Harlem, extraordinary. He sees the vision, right? He says, I want to create a national moment out of this. Nobody bites. There's not a lot of networks. There's not a lot of options in 69 like there are today. There's a handful of major networks. None of the networks naturally buy this and do that. He sells one TV special of the first weekend to a local CBS affiliate. So they air it late on a Saturday night, I think 10 or 11 o'clock on a Saturday night in July. Not a lot of TV, not a lot of eyeballs at then, right? Relative to the time. He theoretically sells a second episode to ABC a few weeks later. We did the research. We see the listing, but we don't see the review. So we don't know for a fact that it ever aired. We had a copy of the CBS show. We didn't have a copy of the ABC show. So I don't think it aired. So we weren't able to confirm that it did air. Even if something's listed, doesn't mean it necessarily aired. But that's it. Then 10 years later, he digitizes the footage onto 1-inch, or he transfers a dub onto 1-inch reels. He tries to sell the idea again. No one really bites. You know, he knows he has this footage, and for years it just sort of lays dormant. Like, I think part of it is that he couldn't find a willing partner to purchase these specials from him. Also, probably what he thought was really special. So it's not like if someone came to you and said, I'll give you $50 for this, he's not going to do it for $50, right? Like, so, and that largely went on until the early 2000s. There's a archival company that learned of this footage, went to him and was like, you know, I want to license this stuff piecemeal. And I think Hal did the deal because he's like, well, I don't want to do nothing with this footage. Nothing really materialized out of that. I think some of the Nina performance or her set was licensed to a DVD at some point. But then I think 2008-ish, this guy, Robert Fivelin, who's a co-producer on the film, he had heard of this footage. He went to Hal and he's like, listen, like, this is, you know, I think someone had tried to make a documentary at some point in the early 2000s, but they didn't get it off the ground. They didn't get financing. Hollywood is littered with projects that, you know, don't get off the ground. But Robert came to Hal and he's like, look, I think I have the team and the experience in order to make this happen. Robert's journey with this begins in 2008, I think. So for him, it's been a long journey. And he was sort of striking out with people. I think the catalyst was finding Questlove as the director. I think this Black story being told by a Black director, and Questlove in particular,
right?
Everything clicked, right? So I don't think it's a lack of people wanting it to be exposed over 50 years, but those 2-inch masters sat in his basement for 50 years. Like, we digitized them fresh in 2019. and they hadn't been digitized. Like there was mold and glue was on them. And so I think the broader question is, why was this event lost to history for 52 years, right? Like right. The footage has a lot of story to it, but the event itself was lost for 52 years. Like no one, except for really the people who went to the Harlem Cultural Festival, knew that it happened. I think the New York Times did one or two stories about it, but not, they didn't treat it in the big thing that it was. And
right.
I think it's a combination of just people don't feel that Black history is American history, I think, for a lot of those years. Mm. And I think, I don't think people realized how special it really was, right? If there's not a lot of things written about it and no one's seen the footage, then how are you really to know that this thing was that special?
Man. And why this movie is so, so important. Watched it with my mom last night, who was born in 56, and she was just not stop talking. Like, this was us. This was everything. So I'm like, I will tell Joseph tomorrow that you thoroughly, the older Black woman demographic you have,
listen, you have satisfied. The audience demographic is hot for this movie. I really love that.
Totally, totally. Kind of just staying on that idea of why this story hadn't been told previously and this idea of the moment. In the last couple of years in America, there's definitely been, you know, a racial reckoning that has brought us the Black stories. Kind of every streaming service has a weird Black stories channel now.
Weird, right?
It's very, I don't look at this Friday as a part of my culture that needs to be shared on a special screen, but that's just me. Do you feel like the things that have happened in the past couple of years, the Black Lives Matter movement, the rush to corporations to want to kind of appear to be upholding Black stories, do you think that this movie kind of rode that wave a little bit, like in that wasn't present, let's say 10 years ago?
I mean, it's weird because we, you know, like I said, this film has a long journey. Amir was signed in 2017. I started in 2018. That predates George Floyd's murder. Mm. It predates Black Lives Matter's national consciousness, really. Mm. I mean, what you're talking about is happened last year, right? Not even a couple of years, it's last year.
Right.
I think even before George Floyd's murder triggered a sort of an awareness that you hadn't seen before, we knew there was a lot of parallels between what was happening in 69 and what's happening today. Mm. I think we as people knew that already. I think how it might have affected our film is that what we realized is we didn't have to be heavy-handed in illustrating that. Mm. We didn't have to show you contemporary footage of police beating Black residents in cities in modern day for you to understand that it's still happening. We could show you it happening in 69 and you, the viewer, will make that connection yourself. The most illustrative scene of that is the moon landing, right? It's this incredible scene where the day the moon lands, Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight, David Ruffin are performing at the Harlem Cultural Festival. Walter Cronkite throws to Bill Platt, CBS News reporter, and says he was at the festival and asked people there, what do you think of man landing on the moon? And their sentiment is, that's great for science, but how about some of that cash in Harlem? Yes, this is more important. Then we cut to that same, a different reporter at the Apollo Theater that night before Sly Stone and Red Fox show, asking people in the lobby, Black residents of Harlem, what do you think of the moon landing? Why are you spending that money when there's so many problems here? That's my favorite scene in the movie. And then what's happening this week, last week, this month? Crazy. You've got billionaires flying to the moon. It's like, or flying to space. It's like, well, why? So I think really the only thing it affected for us is how we told the story. We just realized we didn't have to be heavy-handed when you're seeing it on your TV. You know, you're seeing the effects that are still there. So I think that's really probably the best answer I can give.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. Certainly huge parallels, you know, with the whitey on the moon. You know what I mean?
We could have asked for better marketing than in space.
You know, you mentioned Questlove, and I just want to take a brief second to like bring him up. And, you know, can you give us sort of like your inside, you know, scoop on just the working process with Questlove and his development as, you know, a director. How did that go and how was it?
I mean, for me, I've known him for 25 years, right? Like how I met him is I was a music journalist, and my first cover story as a music journalist, which is sort of like, you know, the pinnacle achievement of your career where you, when you get your first cover story, was for Rap Pages magazine. It was on the Roots. It's 1996. It's their first cover story in America as a band. I get flown from the Bay where I was living at the time to Philly. I interview the group and I love the Roots, and I interview them. I meet them, do the interview, and something with Amir and I just clicked. And I think what it is that he's a fan of music. He knew my byline. He knew the reviews I had written. He's like, why'd you give Common's album 3.5 mics in the Source? And it's like he knew all that stuff. Like any of you would, if we just were building on some rap shit. Right. Mm-hmm. And that was different for an artist. Like I was just like, oh, he's just like the homie. I spent the next 2 days hanging out with him, just talking music and nerding out. And we became friends. And I think working with Amir all these years later on his first film, he's not the director. You know, a lot of the director duties that a normal director would do was collaborative between us. But he, as a storyteller, he's a natural storyteller. He sees things in the room that nobody else can see. And he's just, he still has that fan's heart, you know. Mm. He still has the same curiosity as a fan. He still geeks out when Sonny Chirac is doing a guitar solo. He's like, we got to figure out a way to put that in the movie. Like he's just, he's a genuine music lover, a genuine fan, and at heart.
Nice. I feel like this is kind of the public sentiment around this is that this film has been a little bit of a rehabilitation of the image of the fifth dimension. Are you aware of this narrative?
Well, let me say one more thing about Amir. He's also mad annoying. Because the other thing about Amir, and I'll get to your fifth dimension question.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing about Amir is that, like, I kind of love this part of it. He talks in pop culture references. So he'll be like, oh no, this is like the ending of Purple Rain. And like nobody in the room knows what he means. I seem to be one of the few people who knows what he means. Yes. If you look at the end of Purple Rain, there's like a little montage of every song on the album, right? And it's just like, or he'll, like, he told our editor, I want to edit this like the Bomb Squad. And my editor, who's a musician, he's like, what? And like, I'm like, oh, it's layered, lots of samples, quick cuts. And he's like, okay, I get it. Yeah. Right?
Well, but, noisy.
Yeah, but Amir, like, he almost, like, he's so proud of these references sometimes. Like, I can tell when he's really trying to force something in, and it's just like, okay, man, come on. And then also, just, like, he has no time. Like, it's like, you know, Amir, I need this from you, and it takes, like, 3 days to schedule. So, but generally fun working with him. Fifth Dimension. I don't know. Is there a rehab of their image going on?
I feel like people thought they weren't cool. I myself among them. Like, I was going to do a thing and put up all the records from the artists behind me, and I didn't have a Fifth Dimension record to pull, right? It's just not something I thought. And then they show how beautiful Marilyn McCoo was and how great their harmonies was, and you get to hear some of their stories, and they seemed a little cooler than they came off. And I think they're aware of that narrative. And so,
I mean, that
is not my greatest premise, but I have one more, which is that... go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so I also didn't realize how cool the Pips were. Like, this is such an interesting, like, view into a world, because there's just not a ton of footage of that time, and the Motown artists, besides Stevie, who just, like, destroys my brain with his keyboard solo and drum solo, which those are high points of the film for any music nerd, but he's known as this polymath. But the polished performances of David Ruffin and them, in particular Gladys Knight and the Pips, I didn't think that the kind of synchronized Motown dancing was that cool, having grown up in hip hop. But seeing that Pip, especially on the left, get down like that and like just be so free, and how much it did add to the performance. I don't know, man. I just like it's not really a question. I just wanted to say, like, it's so great to see these people in their natural element playing for their audience and bringing their A game, and how much music is in this music documentary is really a high point of it.
I mean, it's interesting because Fifth Dimension, I, you know, I think you're right in the, of a certain age, unless you really grew up with it, you can't quite understand how popular they were. Right. For me, Marilyn McCoo was through Solid Gold. Yes. Like I knew her and loved her through Solid Gold. And so I was like, oh, I get a chance to, like meet Marilyn McCoo. Like, cool. And I think, I forget what movie it was. Was it 40-Year-Old Virgin, where they do Age of Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In as sort of like a stoner, naked Paul Rudd romp, right?
Right.
Like that'll make you feel like it's sort of corny, right? But like you see them on stage and that first song that they do is great. It's got like a little jam to it. And then you see how emotional she gets about performing that song. And then also the crazy story about the wallet. Like that's insane that their entire career success is based on fate. Like, and they're so likable as a couple. It's almost like an interstitial out of When Harry Met Sally, the way they sort of finish each other's sentences. Like, it's cool. I really enjoyed our time with them.
Yeah. I can see neither you or Nate has taken a ride on the beautiful balloon, and you're worse for it. Fifth Dimension is dope, been dope. I'm glad they're getting their flowers, and they got to talk about being labeled as a white group, which I think was a fascinating tidbit as well. Can you talk a little bit about what moments that didn't make the movie? Mm. Like, I know you've really got to, you know, chop and be concise in certain things on the cutting room floor. This must be the greatest cutting room floor of all time. So I'm wondering if you have one or two things. I mean, maybe if you can't divulge too much, but do you have one or two things that were like, we wish we could have saw that?
So this is the mature answer, because the mature answer is that I don't want to go too much into what's on the cutting room floor, because I don't want people to feel bad.
Okay.
Right. Fair. Like that's like 5 years ago, that's not the answer I would give, but like, just that's the mature answer. But I will say that we put our favorite bits in the movie, because that's sort of where you build from, right? What are the best bits? I wish there was more of the gospel. That Herman Stevens and the Voices of Faith, that performance is like 10 minutes long of just like psych rock band guitar shit in the back and them just going dumb on stage with a call and response. And we cut to this woman who's losing her mind in the audience. That happens like four times. Like, it's really amazing. The Chambers Brothers. So we play Uptown with the Chambers Brothers, but they also did Time Has Come, which is like their hit, which is, again, here's a group that did us a song that you hear in every Vietnam era movie ever. And I had no idea it was done by a black rock band.
Yeah.
And the single version of the song, which is like 4 minutes long, is very concise. But the album version and the live version of that song is 11 minutes long, 12 minutes long. It is, and it's weird krautrock in between. So one of the clips that didn't make the movie is the Chambers Brothers doing Time Has Come with just getting krautrocky, Kraftworky on the fucking guitars in Harlem with homeboy on the cowbell, banging the cowbell every 30 seconds. Like, so I would say that every artist does a full set, right? Most artists did full sets. So there's obviously a lot to pull from, but the song selection in the movie that did come out is partly based on our favorite performances, but are also the ones that told the story the best.
Well said. Thank you for that. We loved Summer of Soul. This is a hip hop show, but we felt it was important to discuss. It's just a great film. And speaking of the auntie demographic, my parents and people I know from my past keep asking me, have I seen it? And I'm like, yes, I actually have seen it. I watched it twice the day it came out. But have you seen it? And do you want to talk about it? And do you want to come over and listen to some records?
I will say this though. It's funny because it is a film about 69, right? But I feel like so many different entry points. Like Stevie Wonder is not little Stevie Wonder. He's not quite the genius he'll become in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But that keyboard solo with the clavinet and the wah-wah pedal on Shooby D is a hint of what he's about to become.
Yeah.
And that's really crazy. The film is edited like a hip hop. It is definitely edited in a hip hop Bomb Squad style.
Absolutely. The name that first came to mind, especially the cutting around the solo at the very beginning, is Doug Prey.
Right.
It's like a very Doug Prey, like using the rhythm of it to inform the cuts. And I mean, I'm hooked from that first second, right? It's just like, it's a great way in as a hip hop head to this music that's ostensibly about soul music, but that's actually about, I think what you're saying is like not forgetting this important thing that happened. And hip hop is so great at that, of like drawing things through sampling or, you know, remix culture to like not letting things live in the past only and bringing them into a fresh audience.
And to recontextualize it, right? Like our editor, Josh Pearson, is a genius. You know, I think the film really is about Black history is American history.
Yeah.
I think sampling and hip hop is an incredible, is one of the most incredible examples of the way that happens. We definitely had a hip hop sensibility making this film. You know, then you have people like Roy Ayers, who is in Herbie Mann's band with Sonny Chirac and Miroslav Vitu, and it's like, what a band.
Incredible band, yeah.
You know, you have Weldon Irvine as Nina Simone's musical director. Like the way you know that we're in faith to a larger story and not just like nerding out music-wise is we show Weldon, but we don't break at that moment to talk about who Weldon is.
Right.
Because it just would have broken the flow of the story, right?
Yeah, but if you know, you know, right?
You know, but it's like we wanted to show him, right? Yeah. And so like, but it is definitely, I think, a lot of entry points for a lot of different people and tastes and generations.
Absolutely. So
thank you all for the kind words. I'm really proud of the movie. I knew we made a good movie, but it's like, man, when people see and feel the things that you hope they see and feel, there's nothing better.
Yeah. It seems like it's happening on a pretty broad scale. So I think you guys should be very, very proud of it. It's an excellent film. Before we let you go, we wanted to kind of touch a little bit on your history with Soulsides. We're close to interviewing every member of the original Soulsides crew. We just have X left. We're big, big Soulsides heads. It came along at a formative point in our lives, and it's just music that means a lot to us. And since we're kind of running out of time here, I guess I just wanted to kind of say, do you have a Gift of Gab story, or is there anything you can share about kind of the early days of Soulsides that would bring some resonance to that, as he is like tragically passed away so recently?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Like, we started Soulsides, it was Jeff Chang was sort of our Papa Zen guru. Myself and Jeff were the only two non-musicians in Soulsides. It was X, Shadow, and Tom, me and Jeff. That was the original, and Benj, who was a friend of Tom's, who also tragically passed away many years ago. That was the core of Soulsides. Shadow was a genius, we knew that already. We used to all congregate around Jeff's radio show, and then when he left, it was my radio show. And I recently just brought all my tapes back from the Bay to digitize all the times Gab and Latif and Tom would freestyle. But Shadow was the one where he was doing mixes for KML, he was getting the attention of Funkin' Klein and Hollywood Basic and doing mixes for Hollywood Basic. Shadow was the one where we were like, oh, we actually have a label, so the Soulsides could become something, right? And we did SS01, which was first a cassette, then a 12-inch. It wasn't until, and X was like an incredible producer, just in the mold of like Pete Rock and Large Professor, just like, but it wasn't until X was like, oh yeah, my man Gab, he raps. And Gab moved from Pacoima to Davis, not to go to school because he wasn't in college, but we were all in college, and he came up there. You've never met anyone who had a more pure love of rapping and just a huge heart, would kill you on the mic, destroy you. But just as savage as he was on the mic, he was that kind-hearted and genuine and real and honest and loving off the mic. And when Gab came up, he and Tom clicked. We all loved him. Latif comes to school a year, that same year. Latif and Gab form a bond that is just, it was magic. First time I've ever seen like magic happen. And that Gab's presence was when I knew we actually were for real. His skill level and where he would just take shit was when you realize, and it wasn't like I wasn't exposed to a lot. I was writing for magazines at the time. Right. I had my hip hop show. I was getting advanced cassettes of stuff in New York like months before anyone else had it. Like I knew what the hip hop universe was. And I heard Gab and I was like, oh, we're gonna have a place in this. This is for real. It won't just be Shadow making otherworldly beats and compositions. One time you can get lucky, but with someone like Gab in your arsenal, I was like, this is gonna be for real. And that's a thing that I am so lucky to have been a part of and to witness. It's very formative for me. You know, my time with Soulsides did not end in the way I probably would have hoped. I still stayed in touch with most everybody. Jeff is still my mentor. You know, I still talk to Latif a lot and to Tom. I hadn't talked to Gab in a long time, and Latif remedied that last year. Not because there's beef, it's just we grew apart, right? I had seen him a couple times in the early 2000s when they were playing New York, but like Gab and I spent like an hour and a half on the phone last year after Latif. He's like, oh, you all should talk. You haven't talked. I've talked to each of you, but like talk. It was so incredible to talk to him after so long. He was still the same big-hearted rap, feverish rap connoisseur. Like, you know, the pandemic didn't get him down. His illness didn't get him down. He was still very optimistic about what was going to happen. I was making fun of him for the Grubhub commercials and, you know, like, and it was a nice check for him, but like, I was just like, you know, that one hurt. It really hurt. It's, you know, it's Soulsides was so formative to who I am now. And, you know, and Gab was such a huge part of that, of making me, he made me fit in at a time when I didn't feel like I fit in. And to lose him to another plane is, I just try to keep it that in perspective, is just like, he's in a different place and he made this world better.
Thank you for sharing that.
Beautiful. Man. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Joseph, I want to just thank you for coming on the program, as we've gushed effusively about Summer of Soul, but it's all true facts. The world loves it. And, you know, we just wish you the best of success into the future, man. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, man. Peace.
All right, guys, that was our interview with Joseph Patel. Really want to thank him for taking time out of his incredibly cramped schedule. He's doing press for this. He's working on Contact High, the photo exhibition of contact sheets throughout hip-hop history, an incredible exhibition, book, soon to be film. This guy is just extremely busy, and we really appreciate him sitting down with us for a moment. I want to give a special shout out to a special person in my life, Lori Weckesser, an old friend who I've been reconnecting with a little bit through discussing Summer of Soul, kind of her generation's music, and just wanted to say hi. Thanks for listening. Thanks for checking this out. Dad Bod Rap Pod, we're back with new episodes every Thursday, the occasional Monday. Great interview on Thursday, especially for fans of technical MCing. Keep an eye out for that. And just a lot of exciting stuff on the horizon for us. So this is Nate LeBlanc signing off for my compatriots David Ma and Damone Carter. Dad Bod Rap Pod. Stony Island Audio.